to Stay Cool Forever. Just tried to do that with my hands.
Yeah.
Completely botched it.
Puts emphasis in it.
Yeah.
This is the podcast where we are currently deconstructing 90s genre films and seeing if they are still cool today, you know, through the 2018 lens.
And see if there's anything problematic or, you know, if they hold the test of time.
I'm Wade.
I'm Zach.
And this go-around, we're doing Christmas movies, or Christmas adjacent in this case. We did Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
It definitely dies harder. I'm going to get right into it. Sucked more than the first one.
Absolutely. And you saw the first one recently, so I'm going to count on you to draw the comparisons as to you know, what they kept. Because a lot of sequels, they'll just try to, you know, one-up the successes of the first one.
Well, see, the thing about this movie was the entirety of the setup, the plot devices, the whole movie is exactly the same. It's the exact same movie.
Pretty much. Terrorists holding someplace hostage.
Except instead of a business party, Christmas party, it's a bunch of planes that are trying to touch down in Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. Which, by the way, do you know if that's still around?
That airport?
Yeah.
When I Wikipedia'd to see where it was, it still came up, so let's say, yeah.
Well, there you go. All right. I was curious, because I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, maybe, I mean, and after hijinks like this, it's a wonder the airport didn't get shut down. Because they're really incompetent. It was so janky and under-supervised.
My major issue with this... So, okay, 2018 lens. This would never fly, the entire premise of this movie.
Oh, yeah, post 9/11, it wasn't fun. Like, I was just thinking about how, like, terrifying the situation was.
The whole time!
Yeah.
The whole time I was thinking, nope, this would never work. This is actually kind of frightening, you know? I mean, flying isn't, quote-unquote, fun at all.
Yeah.
And then to add this sort of suspense into it. Now, imagine... You know, they do recent movies on airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that movie do you think they cut out for the in airplane showing?
What, how do you, like, the censored version?
Yeah, there had to have been. Like, if you're going to be on an airplane, they're probably not going to show the really intense crash of the one plane that gets taken down to prove that they're serious.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
This would not be a good movie to watch on an airplane.
Yeah, I don't think they should put it on an airplane, but it's my understanding that they did, and they had to edit out certain portions of the movie because like, we don't actually want to cause hysteria based on a movie. Excuse me, miss, is this actually going to happen? Is this probable?
Is this based on a true story?
It took me a while to realize who the news guy was.
Oh, Thornburg, the slime ball.
Yeah, I had just watched fucking Die Hard, and the entire time I was wondering, who the fuck is this guy? Why is there a restraining order? What's the whole story here?
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, you know, he was that one reporter from the first movie.
Right, and I'm guessing he did the same shit in the first one where he incited panic by over-reporting on it to, like, sensationalize it or something.
He was the one who was trying to get the story the whole time, you know? Like, he was driving around and then just kept trying to get in the way of the cops the first time around. He seemed like an inconsequential character in the first one because he was just, you know, just the story reporter guy. And then to bring him back for the dumb plot device of him being an asshole on the plane and then, you know, wanting to tell the story again to get on the network, it just seemed...
You see it from a mile away. Like, the second the old lady's like, isn't technology wonderful? Look at my taser. And I'm like, oh, and they are conveniently on the same flight, Holly and Thornburg.
Yeah.
So naturally, he's going to get, it's like Chekhov's gun, he's going to get tased for being an asshole reporter again.
Yep.
Nothing new there.
Just stupid.
And in the timeliness of the 2018 lens airport heist, like, okay, maybe the first one was like a little wacky with they're gonna take this whole building hostage to rob it. But building an air traffic control center at an abandoned church...
Come on.
...near an airport, and then hijacking the whole airport, their systems, everything, literally holding 15,000 people hostage, demanding a plane, like, this is super complicated.
Yeah.
This is the least convenient way to intercept that the Esperanza, the general guy.
Absolutely.
Like, any other time would have been preferable than setting up this elaborate scheme.
honestly, if you had done just a, okay, they got Esperanza and they're traveling by car, and then you create some sort of diversion on the roads, you know, and then you kidnap him and have a completely different story.
Which you see more nowadays. Like, we're going to hijack the motorcade. Yeah.
Literally, MI6. Same story.
Yeah.
The first movie, that was at least a believable setup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to some extent, you know, like, it's just basically a bank heist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were just going for some bonds, stealing in a vault, and then they knew there were 7 locks on the vault, and so you just take over the building. Makes a lot more sense. This whole concept of creating a fake, you know, control tower in the church, and then just, I really dislike how convenient everything is. You know, with the radio, you know, you got a little mini radio tower, that's super convenient. Mm-hmm.
This borderline abandoned town that just happens to exist within snowmobile range of the airport.
Correct.
So you see Will Sadler, Stewart, the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's like at the airport in one breath, and then in the next scene, he's suddenly at this other place.
It's just way too convenient. I think in real life, they wouldn't have had all those planes taxi. They would have just flown everyone to a different airport.
Yeah, there's got to be one nearby. Like,
there's got to be one nearby.
Philadelphia, New York, like all the East Coast airports got to be close enough together to divert, you know, 1 hour, landed another one.
Mm-hmm. And see, so they say, oh, well, the planes with the right amount of fuel were diverted to the nearest airports, but there's still like 10 up there that can't be diverted. And that makes no fucking sense.
Yeah. And the air traffic controller guy, like, you know, what did he say? Like, rack 'em, tag 'em, and stack 'em, and hey, gang, like, we're fucked down here. All systems are fucked. Just keep flying around.
Just,
like,
yeah.
Bad plan.
Nice. It makes for, I don't know, just kind of an up. It's just upsetting because there would be no story if his wife's plane got diverted. And so that's what this whole thing is. You know, we're forced to accept the premise.
Just on that note, the fact, in the first one, John McClane was the only man for the job. You know, he showed up at the Christmas party and happened to be in another room when shit went down. So he was like the man on the inside saving the day. In this one, I get no sense that he was the only man for the job.
He wasn't totally necessary.
Like, he's, by inserting himself in situations, he causes a ton of death.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the goons, which they reintroduce, you know, like, here's a bunch of dudes in SWAT gear. Like, cool, they're all going to die in a shootout. Like, here's another batch. It happened, like, 3 times. And if he had just let them, you know, execute their plan, a plane full of people wouldn't have died. An entire airport SWAT team wouldn't have died in that construction wing of the airport.
Yeah.
All the goons, the crooked military people, like, yeah, just... I'm not saying he should have let the bad guys get away with it, but he was very quick to decide, like, my cowboy antics are going to get the job done, and collateral damage. There's no consequences.
Zero consequences. He gets to just go home with his wife and ride off into the sunset with poor Marvin the janitor.
Yeah.
I would just like to say, Roger Ebert, at the time, said that this is one of those thrillers, like the Indiana Jones series, that I categorize as bruised forearm movies, because when the movie is over, your forearm is black and blue from where your date has grabbed it during the moments of suspense. I'm going to be 100% with you. That first movie, I was like, oh, there were moments where I caught myself being in the movie and having suspense.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, zero suspense.
There were, like, stakes and hostages, and you cared.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, it wasn't like, we've got someone captive. You know, his wife's in the air, the planes are gonna crash.
Yeah, and I think it has to do with the premise, because they should have just diverted the goddamn plane somewhere. There's really no realistic, you know, cut-and-dry hostage situation. It's a plane that should have gone somewhere.
Yeah. Bad guys are trying to do bad things, and our guy is inserting himself into all of it and causing mayhem, but it's like heroic cowboy shit.
It's so stupid. And with everything that we're saying here, I would also like to note that Roger Ebert goes on and says, because Die Hard 2 is so skillfully constructed and well-directed, it develops momentum that carries it past several credibility gaps that might have capsized a lesser film. Clearly, 2018
sure
puts a different lens on this shit.
Yeah, at the time, for an action movie, this might have been forgivable because you got those payoffs,
mm-hmm.
two giant plane explosions, lots of great squib work. But now, like, we've seen better, more coherent, more character-driven versions of this.
Correct. And I think the payoffs, they were kind of lame. The ejector seat as the plane's exploding. Yeah,
I remember that from the trailer.
Yeah.
That green screen shot of...
Just come on.
It was fun.
I don't know.
But to get you there, what we had to go through.
I guess.
So speaking of, Roger Ebert praising the, like, directors and stuff, I'll just do the stats.
This one is
1990, which they are painfully aware of with their... Repeated mentions. The go-go 90s.
Yep. Well, I got it right here. It's microwaves, microchips.
Faxes and airphones.
There you go. It's the 90s.
Honey, it's the 90s. Remember? Like, yeah. Yeah. Never do that in a movie. It will date it so poorly.
Poorly. Come on. But at the time, I bet they thought, ho-ho, this is fun.
Yeah. We're winking.
We're just, like, campy.
Decades changing. We're worth... devoting a significant chunk of your dialogue to. Because we're really just blowing stuff up.
Yeah.
People are just going to say words, but we're about getting from set piece to set piece. The director, Rennie Harlan, did Cliffhanger, Cutthroat Island, and The Long Kiss Goodnight, Gina Davis action vehicles, and Deep Blue Sea, which was one of those fun, like, so bad it's good kind of movies.
He did Deep Blue Sea?
Yeah. The writers did the first Die Hard... Street Fighter, Judge Dredd, Commando, Bad Boys, Money Train, and The Flintstones?
Oh!
These two guys? So, like, there's some reasonable, 90s action credits.
There's some good stuff in there.
Yeah, stuff you recognize.
Yeah. Stallone was Dredd, right?
Yep, Dredd and Cliffhanger.
That's right.
And, Rotten Tomatoes said 68% critics, 70% audience, which, not to kick...
guess works.
Kick a dead horse, but I think that's generous.
Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 out of 4.
Oh my god. Yeah, I guess it's just like nostalgic love for this, because Die Hard, it's like Dirty Harry. It's a type of action movie that, dads
love. I guess. But, I mean, you can't say that it was better than the first one. I just don't know where he gets off, Roger Ebert.
Did he say it was better than the first one?
Well, he goes, given the enormous success of the original Die Hard, a movie I didn't enjoy nearly as much as this one. Producer Lawrence Gordon and his partners must have crossed their fingers before risking the sequel to a relatively untried director. But they did the right thing. This is terrific entertainment.
Whoa. I disagree.
I wholeheartedly disagree. It makes me wonder if he got paid for the review.
Maybe.
Or maybe he really fucking liked it. I don't know. But that's a bullshit review.
Yeah, it's extremely generous. I want to segue to just... I know we touched on a little bit. I want to talk about the world that this takes place in. The accountability gap. The lack of police when it's convenient. The existence of a police department and SWAT team in an airport.
Yeah, that can't be real. Well, and then to have the, 1980s version of the, bristly captain who's an idiot, needs things to get done. His haircut, by the way, is total early 90s.
Who's?
The chief of the airport.
Dennis Franz?
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest here. I think if you're going to be going bald, you shouldn't be growing a mullet with the hair that's left.
You know what's funny? He looked exactly like the asshole cop who gives him the parking ticket at the beginning.
Yeah!
Except, a little, softer version of that.
And then it turns out that that cop's his brother.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, he goes, meet my brother Vito.
Oh, God.
He goes, hi! And, hi, ha ha ha, we're having fun, your wife's gonna die.
And then they crash the car, and Franz just curses for, a minute while, Mal McLean slips away
with the reporter who, and so there were two women in this movie that one definitely hit on him and another that just wanted nothing but the story. So is it my belief then in the third Die Hard that news reporter chick is going to be the bad person and have a restraining order against McClane or something, you know? I mean, if we're going to continue consuming the same sort of plot device for the walkie-talkie, the hostage, you know, it unfortunately seems contrived, but let's get back to the world. Oh, everything is just convenient.
Absolutely. The airports pre-9/11 where you could just, a gang of mercenaries could hang around in black trench coats, smoking cigarettes, passing explosive packages between each other. Like,
yep.
I mean, like, John's, like, smoking in the airport, and I'm like, oh, cool, you used to be able to do that. But then just realizing that anybody could just show up and hang out. It's not like you had to have a ticket.
Yeah, it's like the mall.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can just go hang out at the mall, but in this place, in this case, it'd be the airport. Which, mind you, nowadays would be really cool. They got the Kogi truck at the LAX. You know?
What's that?
Okay, so the Kogi truck is the Korean-Mexican fusion.
Bulgogi.
Yeah.
Kogi, okay.
Yeah. It's fantastic. They have four trucks, and they're only at certain points during the certain times of the day, and you got to check Twitter to catch them. But they have a stand in LAX.
Nice.
Like a permanent one. You know, and so you would have to just get lucky that you're flying out of one terminal. And so that's all I'm saying. It might be cool to go hang out at the airport. We just can't anymore. And then John McClane is clearly the reason why.
Yep. Well, okay, yeah. Additionally, when the bad guys sneak back through that room, he just, like, flags down some airport worker and he's like, hey, you call in for backup and unlock this door for me to baggage claim so I can go in there. And he's like, no problem, sir. Like, the movie senses that John McClane is, you know, the good guy. Like, this Marvin character that is his fucking dog in a human's body.
Yeah, let me help you.
Like, I got a map. This is what grate to crawl through. Remember you crawled through grates in the first one? Like, I got this magic walkie-talkie off a corpse. You can have it. So now he can listen in to the bad guys. Like, I'll go-kart you directly into the airport police station and show up at the end to drive you off into the sunset. Even though you've killed dozens of people. And you don't live here. This isn't your jurisdiction. Like,
there's problems here.
He never got debriefed. There was zero accountability for his cowboy cop bullshit.
It doesn't matter, though. Because he's John McClane. People know. He's got a name.
I read about your L.A. stories. Just because you're hot shit there doesn't mean you're somebody here.
Ugh, kill me.
All of France's, like, you're a loose cannon. Just, like, it's straight out of a cliche action cop playbook. It's
tropes.
And they just, like, yeah, like, this is going to be the character that just swears a lot and high blood pressure, screaming, banging on the desk.
Just tropes. And then there's always, I mean, I'm happy for the inclusionary aspect of this movie and the one prior, but why is there always got to be some, like, black guy who's going to help him?
Sure, it was the driver.
Yeah, it was the driver in the first one.
Reginald L. Johnson, Family Matters, playing Powell.
Al Powell, yeah. Who, fantastic. I loved Al. Because I watched Die Hard 2 today and Die Hard 2 days ago, I'm holding the candles right next to each other, and that first one burnt way brighter.
Yeah, and like, even let's just, okay, we're talking about character development and this one being more contrived. Like, Powell in the first one had so much character and pathos. He, like, told him that story.
Correct.
You know, about what, you know, like, I, you know, shot a kid accidentally and, like, took it really heavily and, like, really helped out. And the throwback in this one, you know, same with, like, Thornburg. Like, let's bring back the hits from the first one and do the same thing where he's stuffing his face with Twinkies. You know, like, hey, slow down there, cowboy. Fax me the prints. Like, you don't know how to work a fax machine?
My wife keeps telling me to wake up and smell the 90s.
For fax machines.
Nice.
This is just obsolete technology that gets so much airtime in this movie.
It's like when you get a brand new pair of shoes and you want to show them off to everybody. You know, I think that was America in the 90s.
Just slipping in their new their new product into conversation.
We've got microwaves now.
Microchips.
Microchips.
Were microwaves really that new?
I guess.
Because I know a couple movies, like 90s movies, that say, like, look at the magic of microwaves.
Oh, wow.
But, like, I thought those were a much older technology.
I wouldn't know. They've been around my whole life.
Same.
So, I don't, I mean,
I thought it was like a 50s thing, like nuclear food.
Yeah, like a dishwasher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my god, nuclear food. That would have been a great ad campaign for the 50s. It's pretty good. I would just like to take a moment and say that naked Tai Chi scene in the beginning.
Beautiful set. Okay, first of all, the only thing on TV on Christmas is news about this fucking like South American general getting getting flown in and out of this airport. Seems strange. No parades, no reruns, no It's a Beautiful Life. Just every goddamn TV is this one story that, of course, will come into the plot.
No Bond marathon.
Yeah. But I kind of enjoyed it just in like a weird 90s way that only then would you introduce a villain also watching the news and being completely naked and sweaty doing this intense karate. Like, we're setting up that this guy is
a badass.
Just, yeah, psychopath.
Yeah.
Just standing there naked. And my wife pointed out when we watched it that he was very ripped for the 90s.
Were they still very dad bodish back then?
I think so. I mean, you got, you know, Bruce Willis is, you know, kind of...
He is our everyman.
Like, exactly. But in terms of, like, you know, there was, like, the Schwarzenegger, like, big, you know, pumping iron
big
style.
Muscle.
Huge guys. But as far as, like, you know, like, in every Marvel movie or nowadays, any action star is going to have that, like, toned, you know, kind of, whatever, expensive body.
The and, 300 body.
Yeah, and I think Will Sadler or his trainers deserve some credit in at least trying to make him look, like, real chiseled and, like, threatening.
Okay.
And, I mean, showcasing him naked is, like, it's silly, but I thought it was fun.
Okay.
That was definitely one of the high points of, like, oh, okay, cool, so this is our bad guy, obviously.
It just seems so, and again, for lack of a better term, MacGruber-ish. You can see where... In all of these 90s movies where MacGruber got its points from. Yeah. Pretty sure there's a naked getting ready scene in MacGruber.
It's him though, right?
Yeah, like, is MacGruber. Yeah. I don't know. I was like, okay, good morning. You know, here's this man's ass and they're cleverly cutting out his penis because that's what I needed.
This is no Alan Rickman. This is no Hans Gruber of a
supervillain.
I want to talk to you about that. Like, you just saw the first one, so can you kind of help compare with me how the hero-villain relationship, of course, was better in the first one, and if it even exists in the second one?
Well, it doesn't exist in this one because there's a lack of conversation between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were really able to get a grasp on who Hans Gruber was and what motivated him, and... Then there was this, like, obvious opposition with John McClane, you know, who's just a rough-and-tumble cowboy kind of guy. Mm. Their relationship was honestly a lot of fun, Hans Gruber. Alan Rickman's amazing, you know, and in the first one, John McClane outsmarts him with the whole gun scene. I don't know if you remember that.
I have a gun now, asshole.
I believe that's it. So, you know, he hands him a gun. He goes, you know how to fire a gun?
And
he goes,
yes.
Yeah. And then he goes, I've got you now, or whatever. And empty shoots, you know, there's no bullets in it. And he goes, you wouldn't think I'd be that dumb, would you? You know, so there's an actual relationship between the two. And I think that really creates a fine dynamic in comparison to this one, where, again, John McClane is just inserting himself into these scenarios unnecessarily. Like you said, I think less people would have died if fucking Bruce Willis had stayed out of it. But he can't. He's just a cop through and through, man.
You want to hear my theory?
Yeah.
On this?
Before you say that, the whole time I was watching this movie, I was trying to think about... And I got nothing, but I was trying to consider what your theory was going to be.
Mm.
Alternate theory about this, so I'm ready.
Okay. John McClane, the man, had this Nakatomi Tower... you know, showdown where he got to kill Hans Gruber, and that was like an all-time high for him. Like, the most hero cowboy satisfied he's ever going to be with himself. So my view through this one is that he's just chasing that high.
Okay.
He wants another important terrorist kingpin to take down. And even though he's like acting all put upon the whole fucking time.
He loves it.
Yeah. Like, he just really wants to kill an important bad guy again to get that high back. Because he seems to have a death wish for throwing himself alone with a handgun up against, like, trained mercenaries with AKs several times with no backup.
Yes.
Like, there was even that part where Grant, the military unit, like, that guy who was a turncoat, who, like, they don't let him on the elevator. No civilians. So, as far as he knows, there's a military operation that's going to take care of this. But the next time we see him, he has stolen a snowmobile and ridden off to just fucking get a head start and go cowboy alone.
Well, and then he gets a little bit of praise for his work, too. Mm-hmm. The thing is they would be lost without him, which seemed so put upon.
Yeah. And, like, nowadays, when you get these kinds of movies where you have one maverick hero that is uniquely capable of solving the problems, like, let's just, like, take Iron Man for a cheap example. Like, okay. He's smart and has the tools, so he can do things that the military or the police can't do.
Yes.
Or there's a time crunch. He's gonna save the hostages and get the bad guys, because he's a genius with the tools.
Yes.
McClane doesn't have that. He's not uniquely qualified.
He's got moxie, kid.
Sure. And his bullets hit bad guys, and the other
people's bullets. And their bullets can't hit shit. I was gonna say that there were so many wasted bullets in this movie.
Yeah,
countless, hundreds even. And why does every kill have to be in slow mo?
Oh, the okay, when they're in the unfinished wing, when him and
every kill,
when him and Barnes go to the to find the transmitter tower or whatever.
Yes.
Oh, the guy who played the T-1000 was in that. The first dude to fire a shot, and he's like, "Hey, what do you think I am?" And he's like, "A sitting duck."
I knew I recognized him.
Yep, that was, I think, Robert Patrick.
Wow.
It's also a short-lived X-Files replacement for
Duchovny,
yeah.
Oh my god.
But in that shootout scene, every fucking guy gets a slow-mo squib send-off. And if you're not familiar, squibs are the little blood packets that they used in the old days for gunshot effects. So literally all these dudes gets, like, a farewell... like, I don't know, almost like pornographic kind of send-off.
It was a little masturbatory.
Yeah. It just like four in a row.
It was, yeah, and I had to write down, Jesus Christ, what's with all the slow-mo kills, you know? I mean, I understood it in The Matrix. In this, it just seems like, yeah, we want to show the American badass kill that's going on here, because we're in Desert Storm.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a different world, and I think violence was really becoming a very, very hip thing in movies.
Well, there's that Rambo Commando vibe, this idea of a one-man army that I think in part was kind of like trying to glamorize, I don't know, like there's always been a blind eye to gun culture in action movies. Mm-hmm. Like nowadays it's kind of hard to just sit back and watch a bunch of people doing shoot 'em ups, but in the 90s, sure, like Desert Storm, go, and there's like a propaganda element to the South American general being the big bad.
Well, and he looked just like Fidel Castro, man. Yeah,
I thought he looked like a watch model or a Dos Equis guy.
Nice.
He was like a super super handsome, like,
yeah,
general. But like the fact that, you know, whatever, Reagan, Iran, Contra, like there was so much you know, just sneaky undercover destabilizing of South American governments in the fight against communism, that just to say, like, this guy's a bad guy. And Stewart's whole thing, you know, when he's like doing his little Riddler talk on the, you know, like, you are blind and you are deaf, like, Esperanza is the only one with the guts to stand up to communism. Like, oh, okay, so he's a South American dictator, but he's too hard on communism. So that's just like a confused hodgepodge of like topical, timely, like, who's our bad guy? Like, it's the Russians in the Cold War, but in this one it's like, oh, it's some South American dictator, but he's like too anti-communist. Which there were, you know, America installed a couple guys who went too far with the authoritarian shit. And like,
Didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Let me ask you.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about the icicle as being the perfect murder weapon?
Only in Christmas movies.
Come the fuck on. Although, I am thrilled that he stabbed him in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, I think, is the most believable kill point with an icicle.
Sure, I don't think you could get through the skull. You'd have to go through an existing eye hole.
Yeah.
Which is just lovely that you see him struggling. He's lost the upper hand.
It's great.
But he keeps scrambling long enough for he and us to see that icicle, and we all know that what's coming.
Wily bastard. McClane's super trigger happy.
Makes no effort to arrest anyone. Okay, the first two guys in the baggage handling steam room, he's like, you know, what are you doing back here? Like,
hey, what's this?
We work here. Why don't you show me some ID? And then we go straight to gunshots. And that's it. He never tries again to, like, put your hands down. It's just shoot first, No questions.
Our John McClane knows what it's like dealing with a terrorist organization, man. Mm-hmm. He is the most qualified person in America.
Yeah.
As he would want you to think.
I love that air traffic control room scene where they're like, is this what you expected, McClane? And he's like, no, this is just the beginning.
Yeah, full smells it.
He's got a fucking doctorate in these kinds of situations.
God damn it. Oh, so when the terrorists are getting away with Esperanza, mm-hmm. and they're cruising at probably what I imagine is 20 to 50 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. For a long time.
For a long time. How long is that runway? Are you fucking kidding me? And then he was just going to take off with 10 feet?
Yeah, it's not like they have air traffic control telling them to make a smooth takeoff. Like, you got the plane. Someone knows how to fly it.
Jesus Christ. It's just, again, everything in this movie was just so convenient, including the ad-lib ADR that was everywhere. There were so many scenes where you couldn't see Bruce Willis, and then you were obviously getting different taped versions of different takes.
Of one-liners,
and it's just so over the top. The final scene when he's hugging his wife, he's moving his mouth and kissing, and while he's kissing, words are coming out clearly. And I was like, alright. Jig is up, guys.
Yeah.
Progress peaked with frozen pizzas.
Let's lightning round some quotes here. You're not pissing in somebody else's pool, are you? Yeah, and I'm fresh out of chlorine.
What sets off the metal detector? The lead in your ass or the shit in your brain?
Looks like your handiwork. Nah, I only do needle points.
Yeah, well, it looks like the pros are on the wrong team tonight.
Somebody want to run down to Radio Shack and get a transmitter?
I'm just your kind of asshole.
That was one of my favorite quotes. In that unfinished wing airport shootout scene, the last guy has a really strange line delivery of, I'm gonna kick your fucking ass.
Oh, it's yeah.
Like, what? Like, okay, so he's like a pervert too? Like, we really want this guy to die?
Well, so are we to understand then that these terrorists, they're like, man, everything's gonna go smoothly unless fucking John McClane shows up, and then this guy goes, I'm gonna kick your fucking ass because John McClane fucking showed up. We gotta fucking put a foot in him.
Yeah, like, we prepared for this. Like, we were warned. We studied.
There was the McClane factor.
The only thing that can stop us. Like, this plan is definitely gonna work. We're gonna build the air traffic control tower, hijack a plane, hijack a whole airport, blow up a transmitter. We're going to get a military commando unit and an insider to, you know, betray the U.S. government. But if John McClane shows up, we're fucked. So
we are fucked.
This guy really, he was ready to be the hero of his own story.
The taser on the plane, and then she said she tried it on her dog.
Oh, God. Okay, so cruelty to animals.
Try it on yourself, bitch. What is this?
And a weapon on a plane.
Yeah!
Just like, that couldn't happen.
I'm sorry.
I also thought it was weird that the phone situation seemed to work better on old planes.
Oh, yeah!
First off, he walks into the airport and says, where are the phones? And then waits in line to get on a payphone, which is fucking hilarious. Mm-hmm. He has a pager.
Yep, the whole pager scenario. On the topic of the pager, how come the in-laws were never like, hey, where the fuck are you? Beep, 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 beep.
Oh, yeah.
There was no call. The kids were just with the in-laws. And then, you know, honey's supposed to show home with John McClane at, you know, in 30 minutes. Okay, so it got delayed, you know, let's say an hour or so. At that point, there definitely should have been a call. A little beep, beep, beep. Hey, where the fuck are you?
But instead, he gets beep, beep from Holly at the worst time.
At the worst possible moment.
But just the whole, like, calling someone on a phone, like, I assume that is possible if you, like, pay for Wi-Fi or something. Sure. I've never done that.
Yeah, me either.
So I was a little baffled by this. I'm like, did that actually exist in the late 80s and 90s? Or are we just...
Are we pretending? Yeah.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I've never been on a plane with phones. Oh, and then so the reporters, like, put me in first class. Did you see? They were two wide and big, giant chairs. She had a telephone. Am I to assume this is coach?
It can't be. Planes couldn't have been that much nicer 20, 30 years ago. Maybe they were.
I have no fucking clue.
I mean, things did get really bad. Maybe you get used to it. Fucking airlines. Like, how little can we get away with providing? Mm-hmm. And we're all just used to traveling in discomfort like that.
Scummed by the fucking airplanes.
Do planes have a fuel dump hatch on the wing? Is that a thing where you just, like, pull an unlocked fuel dump hatch that says fuel dump on it?
And yeah, you know, that's not very smart. That can't be real.
Yeah. I also thought it was weird that, you know, when McClane is on the wing, like, clearly some guys come out to stop him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, presumably because he's up to something or tampering with something. And then Will Sadler does a few foot sweeps and Street Fighter moves, knocks him off the plane. He doesn't break his spine or neck. And then he just walks back in the plane.
Yeah.
Like, this thing is, good. It's gushing fucking fuel.
Yeah.
No one notices. You did so much planning.
And, so, here's one thing that I did so much planning.
You built an air traffic control center at a nearby church, and you didn't bother to notice that he dumped all your fuel.
So, I think one of my biggest qualms and the biggest suspensions of disbelief here, it began with the plane exploding and then lighting the jet fuel on fire.
Mm.
My homie Mike's a truck driver, big fat guy. He used to deliver jet fuel. Jet fuel's not flammable.
Really?
Yeah. That's just a fun fact. It's like, if you crash with jet fuel, it's not going to explode. It is not gasoline.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the whole movie hinges on this sort of concept. And so I was like, okay, no one even bothered to do that.
Yeah. There are three plane explosions in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
That all... Wow.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
I was going to text you it, and then I thought it would be better to bring it up on the air. Because, yeah, dude, jet fuel's not flammable. It does not explode. What are these planes exploding from?
See, I was curious with the Mythbusters on that. Like, could you, like, leave a trail of airplane fuel and then light it from one end and have it travel up to the plane and blow it up? But apparently that's not even the issue.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And I think that would work. I mean, it's like if you take aerosol with a lighter, if you hold it long enough, the fire will reach the canister and explode. And
blow up your hand.
Yeah. Blow up your hand. Yeah.
Oh, he used hairspray in the, to save the day in the luggage.
And that didn't explode.
No, he just sprayed it in the guy's face.
But then it got shot. And so if we're to assume that planes blow up when they crumple or crash, shouldn't that aerosol have blown up? Because that thing is actually flammable? Just saying.
Not a lot of hard science in
this.
These
are my thoughts.
A lot of air traffic control talk in this movie, which I didn't... I mean, like... You know how sometimes people just throw out science jargon, like, oh, it's a quantum engine or something.
Sure.
But, like, in this, I'm assuming they're using more or less correct terminology, but literally everybody had to be familiar with it. The team of terrorists had to know all the lingo.
Fully versed.
So they could deceive the British plane into crashing.
Fully versed in it.
Yeah.
I like that they had a British plane, a Korean plane, and then, you know, our Holly McClane plane.
Mm-hmm. Full of people in just sad, boring brown and gray clothes.
Yep.
Like, it was the most depressing late 80s, 90s fashion going on.
Could not agree more.
Just bad, bad hair, drab, boring, sad clothes. The plane was even lit to further accentuate just how muddy the whole color palette was.
It was very monotone, almost.
Thornburg had that stupid curly hair. Holly had her blowout.
Yep.
It's a dark age.
I like that they had one scene where she was looking at her Nakatomi folder. They just cut to her and she's like looking at it and she's got it open and says Nakatomi, like, just in case.
Oh, fun.
We're to assume probably she's now the head of the company or something.
Of course. If you survive a tragedy at some, you know, while you're on the job, you're naturally getting promoted. Like, that's how it works.
That's how it works in McClane-verse.
Yeah, her coked-up boss got shot by the terrorists, so she naturally would be next in line.
I really enjoyed how coked up and confident that guy was, and then he got killed. That was great. It's good stuff.
Yeah, that's like a fun weasel death.
Yeah. That's probably all I got. If you got more you want to bring in here.
Oh, for problematic and topical stuff. Aside from the strange underrepresentation of females and people of color, I got the impression that the dude playing Barnes was, like, it felt, I don't want to knock the actor, but it felt like he was acting in a green screen.
Which one was Barnes?
Barnes was the transmitter. We got to get the transmitter, the air traffic controller guy, who literally like seemed on the spectrum and only capable of communicating,
about talking
about technology and frequencies, like just one fucking note the whole movie, and he doesn't seem to be like actually talking to the people in the room with him. Like maybe he was just trying to get these lines out.
Oh, but, man, yeah. A little fish out of water kind of acting.
Pretty weak there. Literally all the women. There's that that scummy reporter who just is fucking delighted to be the first one to joyfully report on that plane crash. Mm-hmm. She's like, I want to get the scoop. Give me the scoop and I'll have your baby.
You give me this story and I'll have your baby.
Yeah, just...
Not the kind of ride I'm looking for. Like, okay, because that's what everyone's offering.
Yeah, that's how women talk. And set up a cool one-liner.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Holly and the stewardesses, like, you know, being a team against this slimeball guy. Like, cool, we gave them, like, the weakest, lowest-stake C-plot of a villain.
Yeah, we're not bimbos on a plane, like...
What I found very problematic was when John McClane discovers the ammunition and goes back to Franz in the police station and opens fire with a machine gun at him in a police station, and no one takes him out. Granted, they were blanks, but if someone in a police station starts firing a machine gun at the chief, someone ought to take him out.
Someone should shoot him on the spot.
I call white privilege.
Boom.
Hot take.
Boom. Movie, the whole fucking movie's privilege.
All right. Is there anything else you want to cover on this?
No. I think, no. So do you want to, me to go first with my, ranking, or you want to go?
I'll go first.
Okay.
We, initially do this ranking on the grunge scale from Bush to Nirvana, worst to best. And, I loved Bush. Mm-hmm. I was in a Bush cover band. And I'm going to give this movie a Bush.
Oh!
I don't like watching a bunch of disposable people die without compelling character story, but the band comparison would be, I liked it then, but now when I go back, it just seems like a bunch of noise, and I don't know what anyone is saying or doing or why.
Excellent. That hits the nail on the head.
Yeah.
I'll second that with a Taylor Swift's version of Last Christmas.
Okay, veering way off of the grunge.
I know it's not grunge, but, you know, it's a Christmas song. It's the shell of a Christmas song with poor delivery.
Okay, I think I know exactly what you're saying in this.
You know, I mean...
The original was great.
Original
was
awesome.
So much to enjoy.
Just like Wham's Last Christmas. The best Christmas song ever written was fantastic. And then Die Hard 2, the Taylor Swift cover... of the best Christmas song ever, Wham's Last Christmas. Just missed the melody.
Yeah, same substance, none of the joy. Her version doesn't even have
the synth line.
Yes. You know that I have a problem with this.
I do know this. Well, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Forgive me for being a little down on this one. I just,
you know.
That's what we're doing here. We're revisiting them to tell you whether or not we thought they stayed cool.
This one didn't.
Yeah, there's better Christmas-adjacent movies to watch. Watch the first one.
Definitely watch the first one.
First one's a joy.
That one was a pure joy.
Yeah.
Alan Rickman's a treasure. Well, anyway, so if you are listening to this, you know, you can check it out on Apple Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, Podmust.
Pippa. We got a Twitter?
Did I say iTunes? We have no official Twitter, but you can hit me on Twitter at LA Zachary K. And soon we'll have a Twitter and, you know, send us your thoughts, your messages. Next week is...
Miracle
on 34th Street. Jesus, or no.
Santa goes to court. That's going to be a joy.
I can't wait for that one.
All right, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.